Red Cow Arcade.
Oh my god, you have it.
Thumbnail fodder.
So what he's holding up for the audio listeners is a movie making nerd by James Rolfe, a hero of ours. So
I've been getting contacted by a lot of people about like when are you gonna do the book, when are you gonna do the book, when are you gonna do the book, when are you gonna do the book? And it almost always comes with a secondary jokey comment of, or do you not have time?
Yes.
And I'd like to remind everybody that the original comments about no time from our perspective was, imagine if YouTube was your full-time job, you could do all these things in your video production. Not, that man is mistaken, time is actually infinite. That was never my position. But I spend a lot of time working out and, you know, multitasking basically. And so if he had released the audiobook, that really, I probably would have listened to it by now, on runs and stuff. But so far he released an announcement video, a Kindle version, which we'll talk about in a second. And then the paperback. There is no hardcover version, which I was a little surprised about. The Kindle version, like everybody's saying that the formatting is like all kinds of broken. Like there's no QA on this thing at all.
Oh, interesting.
And then I don't know if you've seen any of the screenshots, but it shows like, I don't know, like weird ASCII characters, like all throughout it. And it's like sort of unreadable.
It's like all the letters are scrunched together. I think I've seen some screenshots.
I'm not sure why you didn't do the audiobook at the same time, but I'll say this, there's been a lot of laughing, joking, numbnuts about the Photoshop-y nature of this cover. And now that I thought it was kind of like real Photoshop-y too. Now that I hold it in my hands, the conceit of the design is not that bad, but there's something that sticks out like a sore thumb, which is for some reason, I don't know if you want to like pull it up on your computer so you can see what I'm talking about. There's some kind of digital de-age, digital airbrushing going on, like hideous airbrushing going on each of the faces, except for his childhood face. Like like a Snapchat filter, basically, is what he's done for. And one of them in particular is like him looking like he's Jamaican Mon. I don't know why. Do you see it?
There's like a little bit of a... Yeah, some sort of filter on all of them.
I think somebody thought that it might be a nice way to like. There's one in particular where he looks like Patrick Stewart at the end of of X-Men Origins Wolverine. He's like just standing there, like you know, it looks like somebody like took an old man and baby faced him. It is so fucking weird. It's the one in the bottom left.
They all do have like this. It's almost like to make it look more illustrated or something.
Yeah, I think it's meant to be like these are drawings, but they're not.
Yeah,
I think it's supposed to track him from childhood to awkward mustachioed teenager to receding hairline.
Yeah.
But all of them have Snapchat baby face.
Yeah, they all have something going on there. Yeah, it's like an illustration filter or something.
So I want to talk about one of the things that I enjoy talking about with James Rolfe the most is really not any personal issues of his family, whatever. That's not really like as interesting to me as mismanagement of a company that and like mismanagement of like creative endeavors. That those are much more interesting to me. And so the logistics of getting this hush puppy out is, I think, well deserved as like a top 10 kind of like WTF James, why do you manage things the way you do kind of thing. So from what I can tell, this was ultimately self-published. Now, he announced in 2019, I think it was, he was like, the book is coming out. It's coming out this year. And then the following year, in December 2020, he was like, it's definitely coming out in 2021. Well, now it's just about the end of 2022, and he just released it. And that would be, you know, you could say, like, well, there's COVID, there was... But his excuse all along was, like, I don't know how to publish a book. I don't know. I've never done it, so I don't really know, like, what I'm doing. I don't know how to make it happen. And I'm sitting behind the TV screen being like, self-publish! Self-publish! You just go to lulu.com!
And so published. Yeah, I heard that the slobs or somebody was shopping around the book to real publishers, right? And then,
and this is like getting to be classic with him, where it's like, I gotta shoot it in California and it's gotta be published by Penguin Putnam. I don't get it. And the reason I have a little bit of a stake in this is because I self-published a book myself at some point in my life. And it's just a little bit shorter than James's. His, I think, comes in at like 340 pages. Mine's like 320. And it was really fun, actually. It, you know, you kind of do all the layout and PDFing on your own. You know, you do it in InDesign, basically. And then you just throw a PDF at them in color or black and white, you know, and then, like, you can set your own price. It's amazing. Like, you end up with this really cool. And then, yeah, like, they give you an ISBN so you can sell it on Amazon. They give you you know, audible.com, you can publish your audiobook there. So I released everything all at once. Of course, I have no audience, or I had even less of an audience at the time that I published this. But I remember I had written an essay about my third feature. And then when the fourth one came around, I was like, oh, I should do another one of those essays. That was kind of fun. And then it turned into a book. And I thought I was going to do kind of like James ultimately did here, which is I would just write it in Microsoft Word, get it printed by one of these self-publishers, and call it a day. But then our friend Emily came along and was like, you know, I'm a copy editor by trade. And not only did she do all the layout, so the photo layout and, you know, there's like a sides and there's all kinds of nice stuff in here, but she also did all the copy editing, and it turned, like, I'm a halfway decent writer. She found so much stuff that shows that I can't really write.
It seems like James needed a copy.
You really, you know, I hate to say, like, you really do. You really, you know, generally speaking. So, like,
even if you've had this thing sitting on your desk, if you're the only one looking at it, you won't see all the mistakes, you know?
You just won't. Yeah, especially because if you're trying to just get everything down, if you're just trying to remember everything you want to say to the audience, you're going to get lost in the phraseology. I remember color was a lot more expensive to get printed. Black and white, I think the minimum cost for my book at the length was like $12, and then I could mark it up. The hardcover, I have a hardcover here of it that was in color, and that, like, so color hardcover came out to like $50, like, for a book. So they, you know, they basically didn't sell. They're, it's a vanity thing for you. But he sold his paperback for $20, you know, so for a new release or whatever. And I heard that it's doing really well on some site. It's like, some, you know, because the truth is people don't really read. And so he has an audience. And so, you know, they bought the book. So that's kind of cool.
It's almost like maybe publishers were stupid for overlooking this.
And this is, I'm like, dude, like, you already did all the hard work, which was you built an audience. You did the thing that the publisher is supposed to do for you. That was always one of my favorite things about the guy, was, especially in the early days, where I was like, you're just skipping the whole bullshit and just going straight, you know, straight to consumer. So I'm like, so whenever he doesn't just go straight to consumer, it kind of hurts my little heart, So he did finally, he seems to have acquiesced. The slobs made it happen. God bless you, slobs. And, but I do think, you know, I think getting the audiobook out at the same time would have been smart. Yeah. A lot of people, because there are visible errors throughout it, people are like, is he going to read all the errors aloud? the Cinemassacre truth, it's like a Christmas, it's like La Salette. It's just wall to wall. You know, there was, I think my favorite one, somebody posted a meme of Shaquille O'Neal reading a book looking very cheeky. And it said, like, truthers reading the new book. I'll say this. So his wife wrote the foreword. And so the very first word in the book is foreword by April Rolfe. And the word forward is spelled F-O-R-W-A-R-D. So the first word is misspelled. Oh, but Now, I'll get through this, you know, sometime soon. Hopefully we got a lot going on with the holidays, but I have read the first chapter, the childhood chapter. And what James details here is that he had haunted, like he had like weird nightmares, like persistent, frightening imagery. Like he was like constantly haunted, and he leads with the dragon, you know, the dragon in my dreams. And he kind of describes it like he's fucking Batman. Like he's like, so I looked up and there it was, and that's it, and that defined everything. I'm like, oh, I still don't really see the visual significance, like the thematic significance of the dragon personally. Well, like, you know, that Cinemassacre 300 dragon video was, I think, supposed to mean something. And I still actually don't quite. He made Cinemassacre 200 where he detailed his all of his video workflows. I love that. All those retro workflows. Love that. Can't watch that enough. But the dragon thing, I understand there's supposed to be some poetry, some kind of experimental film, some sort of allegory or something, but I'm just not getting it. I think he likes the concept of an allegory, and so he went with this one. That's what I'm
Yeah, I think so.
Now, also one of the things that got a lot of attention on there was he had said in a video, it was like his top 20 favorite movies or something. He reviewed Cuckoo's Nest, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and he was like, as somebody who spent 7.5 years in a special ed school, I really related to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it was like a really offhand. It's like, I've watched hundreds of hours of this man, and he drops that on us. So there actually is a whole section here called special ed school. And he describes being, he doesn't use the word, but neurodivergent. I think this, you know, decidedly autistic, you know,
I don't want to diagnose the man, but like the story, I've read the excerpt on the Truthers posted that excerpt, and it sounds like my nephew who's autistic, especially the younger days. And you never know, because everyone grows to, especially with the spectrum of autism, you never know which direction you're going to go, how well you can live with it, you know, everyone has their varying degrees. But again, not a doctor, but that sounds like my nephew.
Because he had like sensory stuff. Yeah. Like he'd be like really afraid of like a balloon popping, or he would rebel in ways where like he would refuse to go to the bathroom, wet his pants, or he would have like these kind of extended tantrums, these kind of like completely out of control tantrums. Kind of say, I don't know about if you've run into this yet. My kid, Muckid. I've talked a little bit about her kindergarten experience. They have like a feelings class now. I didn't have anything like that when I was a kid. Oh yeah,
definitely. I went to Catholic school. They had like anti-feelings. It was like, you can't have feelings. They're not allowed here.
And it's pretty good. Normally, to me, it might reek of like, you know, a mental health iguana or something, you know, like whatever kind of new age stuff they're coming out with. But no, this is like, they have colored zones. There's like the red zone, green zone, yellow zone, blue zone. And the whole idea is, how out of control are you? What zone are you in? You know, are you green, which means calm and ready to learn? Or are you red, which is completely out of control? Are you blue, which means you're sick, tired, bored, or, you know, disengage or something like that. So it's just a way for children to categorize, like, where are you at? And this is why you're not ready to, like, engage with the rest of us.
Audience, are you blue right now? Are you disengaged? Are you bored?
I'm in the fucking blue zone. Talk about dinner! Not your kid. I ain't come here for your kids or his kids. I ain't come here for any kids. Yeah, so I think it's... Look, I'll say this: if it's as severe as he made it sound, which it's like he was in and out of all kinds of therapy over it, and then culminating in, he went to a special ed school. And I bet at that time, you know, we're talking about the 80s, right? Because he was born in 1980. In the 80s, 90s even was a little different. But so they put him on Ritalin, and, you know, 7.5 years in special ed. And my guess is that it wasn't like the full spectrum of special education. My guess is that he was in class with kids that were like, had way bigger struggles than he did.
Right.
So, because they just didn't have this gray area that they have now. I'll say this, man, for a guy who had those kinds of struggles.
No, he did great. Yeah, I mean,
holy shit. I mean, this is a testament to, like, if you can find something like creativity, art, expressing yourself, figuring out a way to, you know, and I think so far anyway, that could be the power of the book for somebody is like, oh, here's, you know, and look, like, how much of his audience do you suppose is, you know, neurodivergent? I'd say pretty.
I think we're both neurodivergent. So.
Look at us.
Look
we're
at
spending
us.
All this time on this.
So, yeah.
But just to be like, well, maybe, you know, process your kind of obsessive tendencies or process, you know, through artwork. Like, what better? You know, fuck. I mean, when you go to therapy, what do they tell you to journal, right? They tell you to tell stories. No, yeah. You know, so.
It's a form of art. Yeah.
So he found that. So I think that's cool. I think it's cool that he got this out. I'm really looking forward to hearing all about the movie. You know, the movie is one of the AVGN feature, that is. It's one of the most, I think, fascinating parts of his life because it was this giant undertaking. Even with it being bad, it clearly was a giant undertaking, but it was so bad and it cost so much. There's like a cost question here of like, yeah. It ate a lot of time. It didn't give back the way it needed to give back. And I saw some excerpts that kind of indicated that, where he was like, you know, basically I had to nerf my income on the channel in order to make the movie. And, you know, obviously there's theories about what he did with the Kickstarter, with the Indiegogo money or whatever. I don't think any of that's verified. And he does talk about it here a little bit. He's like, no way.
I have to read the book myself. I'm interested. You can't get any more fascinating than James Rolfe, really.
I think so. He said in his announcement video that he was really inspired by, like, Rebel Without a Crew, the Robert Rodriguez filmmaking book. And, you know, this is like, talk about like converging, you know, interests. He talked about All I Know About Filmmaking I Learned from the Toxic Avenger. This book, I've said it many times, for me, really was like, and guess what? James Gunn co-wrote this thing.
Wow.
But this book, I read it when I was 14. And it's, I don't know, man. It's like when you have somebody going on and on about, like, I made blood out of food products, or I made foamy green stuff out of the, you know, there's to a 14-year-old, you're like, I see it with my own child, as a matter of fact, where she, like, she just sees a simple special effect done and she's like, let's do that.
Yeah.
And I've been chasing the high of this book actually since I read it. Like, Lloyd has released, look, I'm doing prop comedy tonight.
Oh my goodness.
Lloyd has released like five others, or four others at least. Make Your Own Damn Movie is probably the best one of these. In fact, I think it's probably better than All I Need to Know About Filmmaking, if you're looking for like a cool trauma. I remember I used to scoop ice cream for like during the summer, and this always came with me. I was just constantly reading it. So what else do I want to say about that for now? So yeah, it's been delayed for a while. We know that, but he has said now on more than one occasion that he began writing this book 20 years ago. So pre-AVGN, he started writing his own autobiography, which is also very James.
Yeah, it's completely. And yeah, he's been shopping around for 3 years. So I think it's been basically done for 3 years. So
I guess so. Yeah. It just, could it have been copy edited for 3 years? There's no like style standards or anything. Like suddenly there'll be like caps to emphasize something, but then other times, not, you know, it just needs a little, just needs, a little polish.
Needs some love. needs a Kindle version that works.
Oh, and then as far as the neurodivergent stuff, he said that they diagnosed him again. So let's say that he's seven or eight or something. So it's like 1988. So I was born in 86. They diagnosed him with anxiety and ADD.
Yeah.
And like, look, like, not to be this guy, but yeah, they didn't really know what autism. I mean, what was the first depiction of autism? Probably Rain Man, right?
Probably. And I'm not even sure they knew what that was.
No. And it came with this kind of promise of like, oh, but you'll have gifts.
you'll be great.
you'll be able to count cards and stuff. So they didn't really know what the hell it was. And I mean, it made a good for a good Dustin Hoffman performance. But other than that, but they didn't know what it was. And so I don't know, sometimes like when we pathologize absolutely everything, I think, you know, you obviously run the risk of false diagnoses. It's especially for like behavioral stuff. It probably would be better if, like, if instead of talking in terms of diagnoses, we talked in terms of treatments, because, you know, at that time there was a path, at least, you know, a documented path for treating ADD and anxiety, as opposed to like diagnosing and be like, well, we're going to treat you for ADD and anxiety. And there's a lot of good things on that pathway, and maybe something good will happen, you know, along the way.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of things in the medical field. It's like they have drugs to give you.
Well, yeah, right. It's like, you know, it's like, pick from the menu of solutions that we have established at this point in time, you know. So it's as valid a way as you could possibly do it. It's just like, you know, it's, there's always a good reason to be like, well, maybe I have something that's nobody's talking about yet. You know, I don't know.
And yeah, maybe you're like, your menu of pharmaceuticals won't solve it.
Yeah, right. You know, I'll tell you. So, I mean, Ritalin, it sounds like didn't do much for him, but filmmaking did, you know?
Yeah.
I often wonder, I wonder if you feel the same way. Like, it, had I not found that like filmmaking thing that I just plugged into, I just tuned into at a young age, like what would have come of me?
Yeah, probably depression. Honestly,
maybe, you know, like, it's like, well, what keeps you away from feeling lonely, purposeless, depressed?
Yeah, you know? I know it's definitely, I think I would just spiral into self-loathing and depression, probably.
Like, if some if the heavens opened and they took artistic expression away from you, you're like, sorry, EJ.
Yeah, it'd be, that's it. Yeah. Sorry, that's it.
Like, find purpose elsewhere, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you I probably could, but it's like, that's the main thing for me. So
yeah,
I mean, it's, I'm always thinking about it.
So I look forward to it. It looks like it's a wonderful opportunity for James to like engage in his bimminess, you know, like, because I think even appearing on camera and talking about some of the things he wants to talk about, there might be a little bit of reticence, a little bit of reluctance, embarrassment of like, are they going to go for this dragon and dream bullshit? You know, but
yeah,
but the book is like full license. We're like, look, if you bought the book, you either hate me and want to hear Frankie talk about me, or you're so into me that like, you'll indulge me, you'll allow me. But he does, you know, for a guy who's pretty passive, pretty humble, whatever, you know, a little bit like, aw shucks, there is a little bit of an ego, self-aggrandizing thing I think he struggles with that he doesn't talk about that much.
That's interesting. That is interesting.
Yeah. He says repeatedly, and in the video, he's like, I hope this I hope that my story is inspirational, or like he said it in, you know, in the movie in particular, it feels like it's like 10 minutes of like, this is just how big of a celebrity AVGN is, you know, and how many lives it's touched and changed. That's one of my favorite memes, is the, this video saved my life, thing. But will he address the duck walk? I think probably not.
Probably not.
All right, let's move on. You want to talk, some quick movie news?
Yes.
You want to talk about the Bobs? The Bobs of Diz?
The Bobs. Yeah. Bob Chapek is fired and Bob Iger is back.
Do you know more about this than I do? Look, all I know is that Iger was there for a billion years.
Yeah, and he bought all these IPs. He bought and built this empire, for better or for worse. And I think he set a lot of things in motion that are still happening. Because this guy, Bob Chapek, has only been there for 11 months.
Yeah, like, Iger is Disney Plus. He is the Marvel acquisition. He is... Yeah, he's kind of like he's everything that Disney can take credit for at this moment in time for its enormous earnings. I've been down this rabbit hole that you've been watching me go down. It all started with, sometimes on our Discord, we'll talk in circles about whether or not Marvel movies, it's like the Star Wars was never a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how much worse is it than before? Or what is the problem exactly? What, you know? Occasionally you'll get somebody who's like, well, no, like, but No Way Home was good. And then this was good. And, you know, and so maybe it's actually not that bad. And I was like, I don't know, man, there's like a distinct post endgame problem here. And I wanted to try to represent it empirically. So it started with, I made a spreadsheet of every movie and show, excluding of course, S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Netflix shows, though I included the Incredible Hulk. So you could critique my methodology, but I think, I think, you know, and I included, of course, the Sony Spider-Man movies, where you have to. But from my perspective, it's every MCU movie and then every Disney-produced MCU show. That to me feels like the right thing. Yeah, and so it started with me.
It was the television series were made by like a different Marvel studio that has since gone away. So this is like all the Marvel studios produced content.
Marketed overtly as you have to watch these TV shows to understand what goes on in the movies.
Yes.
Which so far has not been true at all, except for Wanda with Multiverse of Madness. That's the only one.
Sort of. Even that's kind of like, it doesn't quite work.
I mean, you wouldn't know who those kids were. You'd be like, oh, the fuck is kids? Sort of. Yeah, it would. I imagine it would be a struggle with if you hadn't seen WandaVision. But at the same time, I feel really, I really liked WandaVision, and Multiverse of Madness really let me down with how they paid it off, because they didn't really like address it all that much.
No.
So it started with me. I just charted it. Like my personal ratings 1 to 10. Then I invited other people in the Discord to rate theirs. And it turned out that like only with a few, you know, when you're talking about 30 projects, you diverge a little bit in your opinions, but actually like across like four like-minded, similarly aged guys, you know, you're like, oh yeah, it's, we all pretty much feel the same way about
the trend movies. Line is pretty similar.
You know, occasionally somebody will hate the fuck out of Iron Man 3. Or there'll be some like I actually loved Thor: The Dark World, you know, or something.
I do. I think it's kind of fun.
Yeah. So there's like a little bit of that divergence, but one of our friends is like a data guy, and he was like, you should do a rolling 3-year average to like smooth it out so that it's not leaping up and down quite so much. And then that really did kind of like, if you categorize it by phase, you can see like, oh yeah, there really was this critical, at least according to us, this critical dip around phase 4. So then I'm going like, well, you know, who the hell are we? So I go to Metacritic and I go to Rotten Tomatoes and I get the audience and I get the critic score, graph those out. And, you know, they're basically exactly the same except for Captain Marvel, She-Hulk, and Eternals. The critics loved Captain Marvel and they loved She-Hulk, and the audiences didn't. And the audience loved Eternals and the critics didn't. Other than that, it's the same shit. Yeah. And then I go, everybody goes, well, you don't want to do Rotten Tomatoes. You want to do Metacritic. Same. Because there's always a nerd right around the corner telling you to use Metacritic. Like, okay. They're in the comments right now. Don't look down, everybody. They're there.
Metacritic.
Bad fans. Take about Metacritic, fellas. Bad take. just go away. I only get like 1,000 views an episode. I don't need you. Go away. It's a small operation over here. It's an exclusive club. Metacritic wasn't all that different. It's just that it was proportionately lower.
Mm.
It was like lower by 10 points for across the board. And I was trying to understand what the differences in methodology was, because people feel very opinionated about this. I couldn't really get to the bottom of it, actually. I think what it is Rotten Tomatoes, they just take all of the reviews that they receive and then they do an average. They
rate a review as either up or down, basically, right? So,
but if they only did that, no, the up and down thing is if it's a below or above 60%, but they have to arrive at a percentage, which is a scale of 1 to 100, and they're doing that somehow.
Yeah, but isn't that just like a percentage of what is up and what is down? So if it's certified fresh, it's like, it's basically a thumbs up to thumbs down ratio, you know?
Oh, okay. So like, all right, I get it.
And so Metacritic is more like an average, like.
So Rotten Tomatoes is literally saying 67% of reviewers gave it a thumbs up or something.
Yes. But pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. You just saved me a nerd or two.
that's my understanding, at least.
Go after EJ.
Please don't hurt me. I have kids.
I have a family. I don't exactly know how it works, okay? but I read Metacritic, they were like, well, we don't tell you exactly how we arrive at it, but it's a percent scored based on weighting. So they'll weight some reviewers higher than others. So that like blogs don't get the same whatever. And I assume audience score is every audience member has to rate it from 1 to 10. So of course, what I did for the audience score to make it comparable is it made it a scale of, you know, I just moved the decibel point to make it a scale of 100. So that wasn't very illuminating. And then, except for the fact that, yeah, it's like, it still is proportionately lower for phase four. So that was like, well, okay, well, what about the budgets on these things, the budgets and the earnings? And I did it by phase. I did a bar chart by phase. And what I found was the finances over at Marvel Studios at Disney are very, very healthy.
Yeah.
The budgets tend to be somewhere between, they're normally like 150 mil to 200 mil, sometimes 220 mil. You know, the only ones that were totally outrageous were Infinity War and Endgame, which we'll get to in a moment because they represent an awful lot of the total earnings. I think those were like in the 300s. Like I think Infinity War is, this is according to Box Office Mojo, like 315, and, you know, Infinity War, Endgame is like 350 or something. And then while I was there, I was like, what about the runtimes on these things? What's the average, you know? So I'll also get to that in a moment. But if you look at the bar chart, yeah, the earnings always far exceed the budget, but phase three, like, it was explosively profitable.
Yeah.
Because I guess because of specifically Endgame, Infinity War, and there must be one or two others, you know, like Ragnarok really hit, and there's a couple Panther. Other ones. Black Panther. Yeah. Yeah. It's insane. Like this was always an insanely profitable company. Phase three was just like, and then in 2020, they didn't release anything.
That's crazy. That's like crazy to zero. Think about.
So then we said, okay, well, if you take these shows, you take these movies, because I think what a lot of people are feeling is like, I can't, you know, like I used to enjoy two, three Marvel movies a year. Now I got to watch like seven shows and four movies, you know, it's just too much. And there's, of course, the FOMO element, which they're banking on. I've got it. That's why I'm still like keeping up with She-Hulk. It's the FOMO thing.
Helps with content too.
Yeah, it's kind of handy. So I was like, all right, well, how many more hours after 2021 have you asked me to watch before? So it used to be that the average number of hours of Marvel content released per year was 3.8 hours per year.
So like two movies.
Yeah. And it is now, was it 25 hours for 2020 across 2021 and 2022. 2021 was like 30 some, and then 2022 was a little bit less. So a 560% increase in the amount of Marvel that you're getting.
I think that's too much to ask of the audience without devaluing that property, basically.
And if you get rid of the shows, you're basically back to normal. You're basically back to phase three amounts.
But those movies aren't very satisfying.
No, they haven't been good either. Yeah, so they're like, yeah. It's like, you know, Disney Plus in general to me feels like shovelware at this point. Like there does feel like there's like a brand reputation problem now.
And phase four earnings is a little deceiving because ticket prices have kind of exploded a little bit. I think I was seeing something that, you know, because it's like the average ticket is like $11 now, and back in 2019 it was like $9. So
yeah.
Inflates the numbers of phase four a bit for the movies.
Yeah, you were going, hey, why not chart out like number of tickets sold?
Yeah, that's a harder thing to do because I don't think anybody really tracks that. So you have to do math, and that's not perfect because you have to do the average ticket price, which isn't perfect.
I got some pretty good data, I'll release it somehow. Maybe in the description of this video, I'll share my graphs at the very least. It was fun to do just to kind of get a sense for, yeah, like the earnings are lower for phase four, but not.
So you know, Bob Iger, is he going to right the ship?
Thing is like, was this guy, I mean, what can this guy take credit for and what can he not take credit for?
I don't think he can really even take credit for anything this year. You know, it's like
Iger.
I think, Bob Chapek, I don't think there was anything he even kicked off that premiered this year. So I don't even know.
I mean, like, I'll tell you, No Way Home outperformed Multiverse of Madness, Thor: Love and Thunder, and Black Panther: Wakanda Forever by a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think for ticket prices, I think for Wakanda Forever's opening weekend, like 40% less people bought tickets, because that's the thing, is you have to do the math with the ticket prices. So like 40% less people saw Wakanda Forever than the first week of Black Panther.
Yeah.
So it's a bit hard because the ticket prices went up, but that's what I think the math comes out to.
If you just take production budget, which everybody says like double it for marketing or whatever, but let's just say, were there any times where the domestic earnings were lower than the production budget? There were three times in all of Marvel. The Incredible Hulk, and only by a smidge, only by a few bucks. Black Widow and Eternals.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the average runtime of a Marvel film is 2 hours and 12 minutes.
I think that's egregious. They should really lower the average going forward. I think about I don't know if you want to just segue to Wakanda Forever, but that is the main problem I have with Wakanda Forever, is it's 2 hours and 40 minutes. It has no right being that long.
It's way fucking too long. Yeah, I do just want to say, the only movies they've made under 2 hours in their whole history have been The Incredible Hulk, which was 1 hour and 52 minutes. That's the shortest movie that they've made, 1 hour 52.
Wow, really?
Yeah, they've never gone lower than that. Thor the Dark World, which was also 1 hour 52. Ant-Man, 1 hour 58. Doctor Strange, 1 hour 55. Ant-Man and the Wasp, 1 hour 58. And Thor: Love and Thunder, 1 hour 59. So only those ever were under 2 hours.
And none of those are like phenomenal. I like Doctor Strange a lot, but I don't think of those as phenomenal Marvel movies. So
yeah,
maybe my hypothesis of length of time is not right. So but
if you had a conspiracy theory about this Bob situation, what would it be?
Oh, well, sexual misconduct.
<That's> really? Always, you think so?
That's always in my head with, something happened, change up abruptly happened in Hollywood. That's
my,
what I
my
think
only, was. So I know that he was preparing everybody for lots of layoffs. I mean, it seems like most companies are trying to separate the wheat from the chaff, to say the least.
Yeah. Didn't Facebook lay off some people recently?
Facebook, Google, Microsoft,
Twitter, and obviously.
Twitter, yeah, Twitter's in a league of its own. But in July or June or something, most of these CEOs, these titans, were like, "Now is not a good time to work less hard. Now would be a good time to really show your stuff." I do think I saw a chart that like Twitter kept growing its. It like doubled its number of employees in the last 4 years, but it's only shrank profits.
Yeah.
So what's going on there? Like they just want to make like a summer club for Californians or something?
I guess so. Or it's like a CIA front. I don't know.
Like what the fuck is going on? Like
I don't know.
I think it's because I think the management is cut from the same cloth as the employees. They're kind of all like hippy dippy. We've got more money than sense. This is how the world should be. Paradise. Something like that.
So yeah, my other hypothesis was Bob Chapek is like kind of a scapegoat. He's like they know they have to do a bunch of layoffs. He'll be the sacrificial lamb. We'll bring in the old guard back to signal that we're going to get through this, something like that.
I wonder why Iger came back. He wrote his book and everything. He wrote my book.
Yeah. He was going to be like a presidential candidate and everything.
Was he really? It seems right.
That's the rumor.
I'll run for president. Ha ha. Yeah, interesting. I think my best guess would be because, the layoffs indicate bad financial health. it sounds kind of Warner Brothers-ish. You know, the whole, like, let's change out CEOs, let's be crazy, let's...
Yeah, Zasloff, he's doing all sorts of stuff.
We lost James Gunn stupidly.
Yeah.
Very unnecessary. We were talking to somebody today.
DC's gain.
We were talking, that we were like, you know, is Iger good? Is Iger bad? And I was like, wasn't Iger the guy who fired James Gunn? And our friend Dan was like, well, didn't he kind of have to? And I was like, I don't think so. I think even then, even in the midst of cancel culture, he had an opportunity to be a leader and be like, 10-year-old tweets. I'm gonna let, like, internet drama run this company. Is that what I'm gonna do?
Yeah.
Does the consumer even know this is going on? Well, okay. So let's talk about Black Panther, shall we? So we both saw it. That's good.
Yeah, it's a movie.
It's like there's what's a good analogy? It's like, you ever have like a meal where like there was a pretty sizable portion of the meal that was absolutely great, but then there was like a lot of crap all around it, and it, like, you basically just discarded that and didn't hold it against the meal.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good analogy. Yeah. Maybe you're like, oh, I wish there was more of that meal, or that stuff wasn't there. Yeah, that's Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. What I like about this movie is that they really ripped off the Band-Aid right away. Like,
yeah.
Like, within, like, the first 5 minutes, it was like, oh, Black Panther's sick. We got to save him. Oh, he's dead. And then they have the funeral. And it's that, like, they get through it really, like, economically, and they get through it briskly. And I thought it was really effective. I thought it worked really well. People were like complaining, like, oh, maybe he should have gone out in a battle. I'm like, whatever, he just died, whatever.
I think there's an instinct to be like, can we at least still make it make sense within the narrative that's already been crafted? Like, because it's been set up that he wouldn't die of things like illness, or that this civilization would have been able to, you know, at least write in something explaining why they can't, or just make it make a little bit more sense. And I didn't mind the way that it was treated, because the truth is, the audience knows that the actor died. And like, we, you know, how much fiction are you going to write about the character's death, which then kind of evokes the real man's death? You certainly can't be like, he blew up on screen, you know, like, or off screen. You know, you want to, like, cause the truth is most people know Chadwick as T'Challa and T'Challa as Chadwick. And so there is kind of a reality fiction blurring of the lines here. And so you might think, like, well, you don't have to be respectful of a fictional character's death. And it's like, well, you kind of do. Like, the guy died like 10 minutes ago, it feels like. And I know, maybe someday, 20 years from now, people watch this movie and be like, geez, that was done really weirdly. But
maybe they would say, oh, you should have just, like, recast him or something. But I don't know. I think there's, you know, this director, he worked so... he worked so closely with, you know, Chadwick Boseman, and, you know, I think the art in the story that they tell within this movie kind of works that out, which I think is very interesting.
I think recasting would have been an enormous mistake.
Oh yeah. I think that would
like
be
what, insane. like the guy died, we all know he died. And now, like, here's some other T'Challa. Like, and by the way, like, Chadwick was he's a movie star. So it's not like there's just some other movie star, you know, that can be like, it would have been so distracting, and you would have lost this massive opportunity to tell a really important story, which is what happens when you lose your MVP suddenly. Yeah. And there's a lot of movies about death. There's a lot of movies about loss, but I feel like that is something we all deal with kind of often. And it's certainly something we fear. What if I lost this person? What if this very important person at my job left?
Oh yeah. I'm thinking about that right now with a couple people who are like, if you retired next week, like, we're all screwed, you know? Yeah. It's like, it's one of those things.
Yeah. And so, like, so, you know, it, as soon as you lose an MVP who, let's say, that you were hiding behind or that you were following, and, like, all of a sudden you're the leader, and, like, you didn't ask to be the leader, you know, because I've heard some people say, like, Shuri just ain't it, you know, she's just not. And I'm like, but her not being it is kind of the point in a way.
Yeah. And I always thought Shuri was, like, the best part of, you know, best side character in the original Black Panther. I thought she's got a very compelling, I don't know, just like rhythm to her. Like maybe it's just like her design is really good. Her bone structure. Like she's just very compelling. Yeah,
there's something striking about her. I agree.
Yeah, like, you know, I can't like keep my eyes off her. I think she has a very good performance. She's very charismatic. So I think that was the natural fit for her to rise up. And I think this story, yeah, her not her kind of being angry at the passing and have wanting to, you know, destroy the world, basically burn it down and stuff like that in her like fury, basically.
It's great.
And then coming around to taking up the mantle. I think that's just the way they did it is was really, really well done. Now, there is a lot of stuff that I wish wasn't in this movie, namely Ironheart.
Yeah, my broad criticism would be that it was underwritten and underedited. It was like it kind of came in at both ends. But something else that occurred to me was that the tone. So tone is a really important thing in a story. Striking the right tone. We all know what striking the wrong tone looks like. Thor: Love and Thunder is a really good example of like the tone is wrong. You know, yeah. The simplest way to demonstrate it would be to show you like a scene about somebody dying of cancer and then like Taika Waititi's character jacking rocks off or whatever. But yes.
Yeah, Russell Crowe I noticed that a lot that it was. I mean, still had like the Marvel quips, like, you know, like, and like, I like her and stuff like that. It's like, you know, stuff that doesn't really.
Not perfect, but they were few and far between.
It was much less quippy and it took itself seriously, which I really appreciated.
Oh, and I would say, because Ryan Coogler is like a really competent, really strong director. They're very lucky to have him for this project because God, like it just, and maybe that's part of why I'm very sympathetic to the movie where I'm like, this ain't an easy movie to make. Like, no. You know, I don't know. This is a hard needle to thread and you've got one of our best talents doing it. So they're very lucky to have that. A lot of times you'd see in like Black Widow is a really good example where they kind of get like a Sundance director and she does the intimate dialogue scenes. And then you can tell like all the action was pre-vised by the studio, somebody, you know, so there's like mixed tones. There's not a singular vision. This, it felt like the action was integrated into the dialogue scenes, which is integrated into the character work. So even when the story was badly paced, which was frequently, when there are extraneous characters that are not well integrated into the overall narrative, because it has a strong sense of place, and because it's tonally consistent, I find it easier to filter that stuff out. But Ironheart felt like totally extraneous.
Yeah, it felt like there was a steady hand on everything, even if not everything worked. And the sound design was really good, and the score.
Yeah.
Like, the score is just unique. Like, you listen to it, and it has a voice, it has a theme. Like, there's a lot of Marvel scores. Like, I couldn't tell which one's which and where which movie it goes with, but you can like this, you tell right away it has it really carries the movie through. And if you think about the plot of this movie too long, it's not good.
you'll start disliking the movie.
But if you just let the story carry through with you, I think it works a lot. And I really, really dislike the mid-credit scene, too.
I do, too. Yeah, so for spoilers, everybody, from this point forward. But, man, they did this beautiful scene of Shuri just sitting on a beach thinking about her brother, cut to credits. And how classy would it have been to be like, hey, you know that, like, Marvel after-credits thing that we always do? Not this time. You know, like, we're closing the book on Chadwick here. That would have been really cool. Now, I know that some people are like, oh, but this means that you're reopening the book on T'Challa. But I'm like, but I just watched a whole movie about how we can live on beyond T'Challa. We don't need a T'Challa recast or T'Challa clone, because they bring in, you know, Lupita Nyong'o, it turns out, had a baby with him and they named him T'Challa. So they're basically promising you that there will be a new T'Challa, Black Panther, I don't know, 15 years from now or something.
Yeah, and... I just didn't think it really worked with the movie, and it undercut that really powerful ending.
You can almost like imagine like it like quick fading back up and be like, oh, actually, you know, here's some like
Charles right here all around. There's not a baby in the background.
Yeah, any kind of
it happened off screen type shit.
I'm like, I don't need it. Give me, you know, just give me emotion. That's all, like, more than anything, I just want to feel something. And it had shoddy CG too, by the way. And yeah, I didn't mind. I really didn't mind it because, again, the sound design rocks. The action sequences are well composed, I don't know, some crappy CG in a sequence that is well designed. It's like anything. It's like that old thing that filmmakers say about, like, you can actually make the visuals look better with better sound design. Everything is a trick on the mind. Everything is about, like, selling it to the audience. And you can get away with, at least for me, you can get away with some shoddy CG as long as the sequences are good.
And I thought, like, Namor was a fun villain. I thought, I know some people, because he's in the comics, he's like an Atlantean, and now he's like more Mesoamerican and stuff like that. But I think it's like a nice, compelling design. I thought it was kind of a fun performance.
Getting tired of these villains that are like technically right? They've been oppressed.
But he was like menacing enough that I kind of... I know the gray area villains that are technically right are
they were essentially pitting two oppressed civilizations or at least marginalized civilizations against one another, and then they chose a side, the heroic side. But that was only after they set up like, yeah, but these people are at serious threat of being conquered, and so they're just, it's purely self-defense, it's purely, you know, it's war essentially against like colonizers. And then you kind of like go like, yeah, but... Well, I guess because the story is always, you're both ideologically on the same page, but you're just taking it a little too far. You're like a villain now.
Yeah.
You know, you're too much of a Magneto or too much of a revolutionary.
Yeah. And even Thanos was made a little bit like, oh, well, I'm thinning out the numbers to protect the environment.
Anytime I heard, like the Thanos was one of these gray villains, I'm like, not really. I was like, Thanos is pretty like overtly villainous. If you think he has anywhere near a point about population growth or something, I don't know, like, I don't think Thanos thought about it all that much. He goes with 50% kind of haphazardly.
Half it'll be fine.
Couldn't he have used the stones to at least calculate it a little bit more precisely and calculate like who is the least valuable among us or something? I don't know. Like, he's like, no,
use the stones to just make more resources?
These are the issues, of course. So I'd much rather believe that the guy is just insane, villainous. Radical.
Riri Williams as Ironheart did not need to be in the movie, especially because she's such a similar character to Shuri. Like, yeah, you could have given a lot of her plot points to Shuri, and she didn't really do much in the film or really besides just introduce her. And then she was like along for the ride and didn't add anything. So they could have cut that. They could have cut out Elaine and Bilbo Baggins. They could have cut them out.
Elaine and Bilbo Baggins. Yes. All of that stuff is just kind of trying to keep some of the Marvel threads going, I guess.
It's like, it's keeping those balls in the air. And I didn't need that. The movie didn't need that, definitely.
There's a really strong hour and 50 minute movie in here, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Ironheart probably was the biggest issue for me, just because it felt so... It's like, we're going to introduce a new character. She's going to be a MacGuffin. And I don't know, it just kind of rang inauthentic to me. It felt the most superficial I'd rather spend more time with the general there, you know, and her kind of, I, one of the things that I worried about going into the movie was that they weren't going to prioritize or choose a main character, that they were going to kind of do like an ensemble thing. And then maybe they're all Black Panther. I didn't know.
Because especially the title Wakanda Forever, it says like, oh, it's going to be all of Wakanda saving the day or something.
You got to pick somebody.
The main character is Shuri, and it's very obviously Shuri, and it's about her. That's why I think the movie still ultimately works, even though there's a lot of chuffa, is that, you know, it's about her. It's about her accepting the mantle and coming through the grief. So,
and having a religious awakening, actually.
Yeah.
She essentially is like, I can't flourish. I can't awaken from this depression and this grief until I believe in something higher. She's literally saying like the ancestral lands that they go to when they take the herb or whatever doesn't exist. That's a,
and then she meets Michael B. Jordan in the ancestral lands, which is kind of like a Satan character, which is great. I love that.
That's what you want in your mythical superhero movies. I heard some people being like, oh, I don't want grief for 2 hours and 2+ hours in my superhero movie. And I'm like, I kind of do.
It's like a human emotion that we feel and have to get through.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I guess like in part, it was kind of like Rocky Balboa, like where the movie starts with kind of an unexplained death of a major character. And the story is about the living. The story is about like, what about who among you can move forward under the circumstances? It's like this, it's kind of like the ultimate test. Yeah. Of somebody's character is like, can you move on from here? They could have even explored it a little bit more. I don't know that they needed to do quite so much with Namor and that civilization and all that. Nope. The plot, there's a lot of plot. There's a machine and the machine and the thing.
I don't know.
And then you didn't have a problem with how dark it was?
I didn't. I don't know if my projector was properly calibrated or something, because I didn't. There was a couple scenes where I was like, oh, it's kind of stylistically dark, like, you know, when she's with her mother on the lakeside there and then Namor comes out. But I didn't have an overall problem with it.
Did you have a problem
that she got stabbed like right through the spine and she was like fine at the end?
Oh yeah, is that like I had to explain that away with like, I guess that's the Black Panther powers.
Yeah, I guess so. But like especially because she's very thin, like I don't know, she needs to,
yeah, you feel bad for her.
She needs to eat. She needs to eat. But
there's something about that her lankiness though that I find compelling.
It's definitely, she's got a good character design as a human, but but the fact that her waist is so skinny and then she's stabbed, it's like, you got her spine.
Her organs are pretty packed in there. You see like Kevin Smith posted yet another one of these like kind of awkward close-up photos of him crying.
Well, why does he keep doing that?
Yeah, he was crying over the mid-credit sequence that you and I hated.
Oh!
So he's in the movie theater and he's all... and I'm like... So he caught a lot of shit for this time. This time, the internet wouldn't have it. I mean, people have been having less and less patience for Kevin Smith over the years. And this time, this one feels like people are like, fuck you. And of course his reaction was like, wait, I'm allowed, aren't we all supposed to feel emotional about this movie? And it's like, now it's more like, what is this photo? What is this? Like, why are you tweeting it? Why are you, and don't you cry at everything? So it hasn't it lost its impact. And,
you know, it's a show.
It's too much of a show. It's very social media of him. And maybe some of these kind of gauche social media gestures will become less and less popular. You know, they become more of a social faux pas. Like, you're not, you know, to
you need a proper amount of mocking for it.
Yeah, he was very upset that he was mocked so thoroughly for it. All right. Well, you know what? Speaking let's talk about some fun stuff first, actually. So I bought something stupidly. Look how teeny.
Oh, you got that thing.
I got
the Genesis 2 or Genesis M2.
Genesis 2. And it comes in a little box. And this box packages in the 6-button controller as well. So they're like, the 6-button controller is it's noticeably larger than the system itself.
Yeah.
And of course, there is a Sega Lord X, was very disappointed to see that the Switch, because this is a Genesis 2. It's not a push. It's a slider. And it's because it was the base model was the Japanese one. And that was the Mega Drive 2. And that did have so they just didn't really modify that. They just
recolored it basically.
So it's cool. I like it. I just felt like I should get anything that releases with this eclectic, a collection of games, just felt like because it has a bunch of Sega CD on it, as we've discussed. And it'd be even better if it had some 32X on it. They should have grown a pair and put some 32X on here.
Yeah.
But maybe they'll have a 3, because there was a Genesis 3, you know.
They should have like gone the extra mile and somehow got Popful Mail and Lunar series on there.
But of course, I'm sitting here talking about all that stuff as if I don't have this Hush Puppy back here that plays all of them. Oh, yeah. And as if I don't have my handheld, and as if I don't have my Super Console X.
So it's exactly why I didn't get it. I saw the pre-orders go up, and I noped right past it.
But it did push me to buy an 8-bit Do controller. Forgive me, by the way, if it's 8-bit Do. I don't know how it's pronounced. I've been saying 8-bit Do this whole time.
Yeah, I don't know.
They sell a 6-button Genesis-styled controller that's wireless, and it's the 2.4 gigahertz. Where I gotta tell you, the 2.4 gig, like, that's the way to go versus Bluetooth.
Yeah.
You just pop it in and out of other systems. And so, you know, with Bluetooth, you got to unpair. Like, it can't pair if it's already paired. Lag. Yeah. Yeah. The lag is worse, I think. These are wonderful. But yeah, I really like this thing. And it actually, the D-pad feel, because Genesis controllers notoriously had kind of rough D-pads. This works that right out. It's a Genesis controller with shoulder buttons.
Right. That's cool.
And it's got, the very nice, mode or home buttons like you would expect.
I'm lousy with 8-bit Do controllers. I got this tiny one here.
Can't buy enough of them. Can't buy enough of these fucking things.
I got a bunch.
I don't know. Sometimes you buy something for no good reason, but, it kind of inspires. A little
bit of retail therapy, as they say.
Yeah. You know, it's fun to get the box. I don't know. But when you only have like 20 games or however many there are versus 18,000, it does at least make you go like, all right, let me like give Rystar a real try here.
Oh, that's a good game. That's a great game. Have you played that?
Yeah. I played through a bit of it. Yeah. I really like the mechanic. It worked. Actually, it takes a little bit of getting used to, but it's, I love a good retro platformer. They got Earthworm Jim 2 on there.
Well, because it's like it was released late in the Genesis, so it has a little bit of like a Sonic 3 and Knuckles vibe, but it's a different character. The
graphics are awesome.
It's very interesting.
So that's totally fun. And on my retro gaming journey, I bought a 9-inch CRT television with built-in VCR. So last time, you might remember, I talked about how I think that VHS collecting is going to kind of catch on someday. I don't think soon, but I think someday. And I was like, you know what, man, if you want one, if you want a combo and you want it to be not like a functional Panasonic 9-inch CRT television with combo VCR, every year those are going to get more expensive because they're going to function less and less and less. And especially if you want the remote, the classic remote and everything. So I was like, I'm gonna snatch one up, and I won't tell you what I paid for. It's too much. There's probably people who are like, I could have sent you mine, but I put it. It's the perfect size because I have a desk where I have only a single.
Did you get it on eBay? Is that what you did? Or
yeah. And there were a lot. There was like Zenith. There was like a lot of kind of lesser brands, but I was like, I'm gonna go with the Panasonic. It's so small, and I love how small it is. I love like just where it's parked. And I got my top loader right there, and being able to like rock out like a quick, like Chippendale Rescue Rangers while waiting for a meeting to start, very surreptitiously play some NES. And then of course, while I'm sitting there, I'm like, sure, it would be nice to have an EverDrive, cause I don't have an EverDrive. And if back in the summer I was trying to get one, and they were all, at least the Pro and stuff, everything was marked up and they were all sold out, but they've restocked. And so I grabbed one. And I grabbed an N64 one as well, because I was like, that's the only way you're really going to be able to play N64. Now, you got the CRT television, you got the original system, you're not going to collect, you're not going to go around buying Snowboard Kids and shit. So, like, just get the $190 EverDrive and
I have a CRT TV down here, but it's too big. I would love a 9-inch on my... on my desk.
I recommend it.
Because we got that like Sylvania one for Junt's Nest, and I remember that being like looking really good for how small it was.
Yeah, well, like I don't know what the native resolution of an analog like NES is, but it's I think it's probably bigger than that TV. And so it looks really quite good. But I sometimes have the instinct to be like, oh, the picture quality should be better. Maybe there's something wrong with the connectors. And then I'm like, no, Frankie, this is a TV from 1991 like, with analog connections. The whole point is that it's going to be a little fuzzy with some, you know, interlacing and stuff.
Yeah, they design it like the like some of the chunky pixels that you see when you put it on, you know, an LCD screen, like on those tube TVs, it kind of that you can see it like they were actually designed it to be like shading or something. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. When those EverDrives come in, that's going to be a good damn time. Yeah. OK, so. Oh, one final thing. I saw the first episode of Tulsa King.
Oh, the Sylvester Stallone TV show, right?
Yeah, they're it's on Paramount Plus. I own Paramount Plus for some reason. I actually bought it originally because there's like an Alvin and the Chipmunk show on there that Gloria really liked, and originally. It was really cheap. It was really cheap. It was like, I don't know, like if it was like $60 a year. I mean, it was really cheap, and riddled with ads. I went with the cheap version that has tons of ads, but you know, there's South Park, there's Beavis and Butthead. There's been some stuff I've watched on there. There's like Dora for her and Nick. They have all of Nickelodeon on there,
that's good.
Or some of. They have some. I think they split it up with Netflix. I think Netflix grabbed like classic Nick, and I think that they have like modern Nick. They have maybe like Ninja Turtles. I think Netflix has Ninja Turtles. But they definitely have Dora, and they definitely have SpongeBob. It might be SpongeBob specifically that they were able to negotiate. Oh, fucking streaming wars.
I know. It's like, it's so segmented. And then, of course, it's the joke. It's like someday they're just going to like bundle it and recreate cable.
Yeah, pretty much. We're
bundle all the services.
So Tulsa King is about a 75-year-old man played by Sylvester Stallone, who not very long ago, like two episodes ago, I said, this man's a movie star. He shouldn't be on television. And I hope he's never on a TV series. And now here he is on a streaming TV series. But I should have accepted a long time ago that these TV series are just long movies. It's just where the industry has gone. And so he's 75. He's a mobster, Italian mob, you know, of the stereotypical nature. And he took the fall for his boss, got 25 years for it, is looking for some compensation, gets in a heated debate with them, and they say, fine, your compensation is that you can run Tulsa. And he's like, isn't that just like this backwater place? And they're like, yeah. And the joke, it's kind of like a man out of time, like where, because he's old and he's, the last time he was in civilization was 25 years ago. So he's new to the iPhone. He's new to lingo. He's new to what's legal. So the big gag, I think, in the episode was he's looking for a place to set up a front. And he sees like a marijuana dispensary. And he goes in there thinking like, you know, my services will be, you know, this place produces a lot of cash. I'll shake them down. I'll tell them that I'll keep them safe from the law. I'll keep them safe from rival gangs. And they're like, but it's all legal. It's all like lame, like soy hippies, you know, and they're like, it's all legal and it's just cash only. And we don't really get a lot of crime through here. Like you're actually the one bringing all the crime. And so that's kind of the gag. But other than that, I think
I saw an interview with Sylvester Stallone. He's like, oh, making TV is much harder than a picture. You know, he was like,
you got to be there the whole time.
You got to be there. It's like making a movie. It's like you're going on vacation.
He's like, oh my God.
Oh my God. You got to work every day.
Well, he insists on being an executive producer. I've heard him say like, basically he doesn't want to be in projects that he doesn't have a lot of creative influence over because it's such a time suck, especially at 75.
Yeah.
Where he's like, yeah, I want it to be worth it. I don't want to just kind of go for the ride anymore. It's not bad. It's not bad, but it's also not great. It's like some basic bitch TV. I gotta tell you. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's not WB. It's not network television. It's dressed up for sure, but I wouldn't say the themes will knock you on your ass or anything.
Yeah, I was trying to stray away from, like, you know, only watching Marvel stuff. So I was checking out some other shows, or only watching Star Wars. And I like checked out the show Dark Winds. It was on AMC Plus or whatever it is. It's because I still had it because of Better Call Saul, and I was just like, ah, I have one more month left, so I'll watch this.
Yeah,
because it was like I think it's produced. George R. R. Martin's a producer on it, but it has a very interesting like setting. It's on like a Navajo reservation. It's kind of a whodunit murder mystery on there.
Oh, cool!
And the cast is mostly like Native American and stuff like that. And so it's very like an interesting premise, an interesting cast. But like at the end of the day, I feel like it's produced like a very by the numbers TV, very unartful. And so
yeah. It's expensive, like, but.
It's and you know, and then at the end of the day, like the whole season was like, you could have wrapped it up in one episode of SUV, you know, or SVU, you know, like a special victims. Yeah. It was like, it was just like a whodunit by the numbers, but it was stretched over a season. So it's like,
it ain't true crime.
Yeah. It's, you know, it was okay. It was interesting. It was kind of disappointing because it was such an interesting premise with the cast and location, but
yeah.
Ultimately, it's like, man, it's so hard to find like good television.
But at the same time, I can't help but be like, you know what, though? I like the actor. I hate a lot of the franchise stuff that's coming out.
That's
like,
true.
If I spent all of my fiction narrative time on like just kind of a reliable, mildly entertaining thing, you know, would that be good enough?
Yeah, I checked out a couple more episodes of Andor.
Yeah, so
I think I'm liking it a little bit better, but it's I don't know. There's some mojo that's missing. I'm not at the good episodes that you've gotten to yet.
Yeah, you're still in the valley. I was right there with you, and I don't think you would have heard me say that I was liking it more where you are.
The Skarsgård guy there, what's his first name?
Stellan
Skarsgård.
Ezzy and Amber.
Cassian Andor. When I heard him say that, I like laughed. I was like, oh, he just doesn't even care. It's like they probably told him how to pronounce it. He's like, I don't care. Cassian Andor.
Say Cassian. Cassian. Say Andor. Andor. Say Cassian Andor. Cassian Andor.
But he's awesome, though. I mean, you can't keep your eyes off him. He definitely brings up the production a lot. I love it when he gets into his like more like foppish disguise for Coruscant and stuff like that.
I don't know why, man. Like, there's something that does capture my imagination about like the aristocracy, the sort of like, yeah, the complacent aristocracy of the that's too aloof and too stupid to realize like this whole, or maybe they know full well like, yeah, this galaxy has gone to hell in a handbasket. But
yeah, it's like the Hunger Games, like the capital city people who are just like so elaborate and fat and
decadent.
It's got some of that going on, which is kind of interesting.
It's a lot more sophisticated.
Cassian Andor himself is not very interesting. He kind of like fades into the background of every scene, even if he's like the focus point.
He's not it.
It's like every scene he's like, you, like other character, you do the work, because like I'm not gonna do it.
Can you guys do it?
Like, you know, he doesn't like carry any scene. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, Stellan carries a whole lot of it, and then Andy Serkis carries a whole ton of it. Nice. I mean, at least for three episodes or something. I mean, really, like I'd be very surprised if you got to those prison episodes and you weren't like, wow, this is captivating stuff. Like,
you really do have to recalibrate your brain, because they put so much like naturalistic dialogue into it. The editing is like looser. It's a very like, I don't know. It is like kind of like a mumblecore indie film in that way.
Yeah. Like even though I've basically come around on it, I can't abide those first 6-7 episodes of boredom. And
it makes you wonder if they like midway through the season, they knew it wasn't working and they recalibrated the, the season to work better or something. I don't know.
I've sometimes wondered, I'm like, well, what would you have done? Like, would you have just started it at the part that you liked, you know? And I'm like, well, no, I think you do need to lay the narrative groundwork that they did. And it was probably the right way to go about it. It probably was the right characters to follow. Like everything, you know, in retrospect sort of feels right. It just move a little fucking quicker. Would you like
tighten it?
Yeah. But
yeah, I don't think I don't think I've disliked what I've seen. Yeah. It's just, I feel myself drifting so often.
I could barely but then, yeah, you'll get to those episodes and I think you'll be totally plugged in.
You'll get to a Skarsgård and you're like, yeah, sweet.
I mean, you never heard such good dialogue in a Star Wars thing the thing that admittedly I am driven a little bit crazy by the fact that there's people out there that are like, wow, this is really authentic to Star Wars. And I'm like, I don't know what you're smoking. Like this is some other thing. I've now come around to liking it, but it is not Star Wars. It's like decidedly not Star Wars. Like in many ways, it's the opposite of Star Wars. Like it has a lot more in common. There's a lot of other kinds of sci-fi that it has a lot more in common with.
Yeah. It feels more like a Dune or that kind of prestige sci-fi in a way.
Star Wars is not about the nuts and bolts of how you are tyrannized. No. It's about what happens inside of you, you know, in relation to your destiny, to your father, to your wife, to your,
Yeah. And what I will say is the production design is way better than Obi-Wan Kenobi. It feels like they spent their money more smartly.
Yeah.
Where things feel a little bit more lived in. It doesn't feel like you're in a cramped volume space. It looks a lot better than Obi-Wan Kenobi, which had a very cheap look to it for some reason.
Yeah, I think that it feels like it was slapped the fuck together. Maybe they spent it all on Ewan. I bet Ewan was expensive. And I bet the other actors in this thing aren't that expensive.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Andy Serkis probably was. Maybe Stellan, I don't know. What does Stellan Skarsgård charge after Chernobyl?
Oh, Chernobyl's great. Have you seen all of Chernobyl?
Not all of it, but I really like the first episode or two.
I mean, that first episode is a masterpiece. And then the rest is good, too.
Yeah, that was super good. Yeah, so finally, the only other thing I had on the list was, Jason David Frank, Tommy the Green Ranger, possible suicide, but he died November 20th or November 19th. And it's I think, very depressing, obviously. But, there's something, man, about, a perfectly healthy person and body, and some people wrestle for their lives, and something, obviously, I don't know if it was this family situation or what, but something fucked them up. But I'll tell you this, everybody has a fictional character that when they're a child, I'm sure you could pick it, take anybody and be like, where did you derive your strength from in fiction? You know, whether it's Batman or whatever. And
we lost him too. Was Batman?
Oh my God. Are all of our heroes. Yeah. But there's a cohort of us that probably I fit exactly into.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like from age 7 to 10 in, 93 to 96, that this guy, this Power Ranger was that character. And
yeah, he was the coolest, most compelling character on TV for us, especially because of he started off as a villain character and then he became good, basically. And there was that simple redemption story was just automatically made him cooler. Made him
even to a child. I think even to a child, because everybody's favorite was the Red Ranger. And then Tommy the Green Ranger comes along and everybody likes him better. And yeah, I swear it's because it is better to be, to fail and be redeemed than it is to have not failed in the first place. I think there's something about storytelling where, yeah. I mean,
well, the story of the prodigal son,
it's all over Christianity.
Cause you have the faithful son who never strays. And then you have the prodigal son who strays and then comes back and he's more celebrated. Mm-hmm. And then the faithful son's like, hey, what'd you do? Why are you celebrating him? I was here the whole time. And, you know, he's basically like told off like, hey, you know, it's better that this guy comes back, you know?
You could argue that the entire basis of Christian philosophy is like, there's this original sin. There's, you know, you failed in the first place. And you would ask like, well, why would God create people that had the capacity for failure if he wanted to create paradise? And it's like, well, because the divine plan is actually to have forgiveness and success out of failure. It's actually better than purity. Yeah. Something like that.
And that's why Tommy was awesome.
So that goes a little deep. If you look through that prism, I think like you'd find so many stories, or even your own story, where you're like, wow, like I'm actually glad I fucked that up, you know, and so that I could do this next thing better and grow. And I think children identified that. And plus he was kind of like an alternate Red Ranger. He was just as tall. He was just as talented. They kind of pitted them against one another as kind of like mirror copies of one another. And he not only became good in the story, but he went on to be the leader, and he went on to be like every iteration of Power Ranger you could be from that. He became like Red Zeo. He became Black Dino, Red Turbo, of course, the White Ranger. Man, when I was a kid, when he came back as the White, because there was this whole very angsty season of Power Rangers where he was losing his powers and he eventually lost them entirely. And you were back to the original five. And it just felt, as a child, it felt so much like we had come so far just to return back to the original five, you know?
Yeah.
And then he comes back triumphantly with, you know, fully powered. But yeah, like I remember getting braces and being really scared, being like, what if it hurts or whatever? And my mom being like, just, you know, you're the Green Ranger when you sit in that chair. Or, of course, I dressed up as him. And I was part of the Power Rangers fan club. And they package in these photocopies of autograph, you know, every actor in their sort of Halloween costume. Because the American version had the more Halloween-y costume version of the, versus, and much thicker too. Versus the Japanese. And I had the Jason David Frank one.
Nice.
And this one is quite a bit more kind of wrinkled and beaten up than the other ones. Cause this was like, this would like come in the, you know, in the car with me. And I'd be like, oh, I could dress up like that. And I could be like him. And,
I remember when the movie came out, the McDonald's had these, the little figures in vehicles that they could ride. And it was like a lottery, which one you got. And I remember being so happy I got the White Ranger.
Yeah.
And because it's like that's the only one you wanted.
He was a wicked draw for that movie. And the movie knew it. Like there was at the beginning of the movie, they skydive.
Right. And
they create, I don't know why. And they had a character in there, like a child. Because normally Power Rangers didn't really have children in it.
Right.
Though ironically, Super Sentai always did. Like almost every episode is about some Japanese child.
That's really interesting.
Who's paired with one of the Rangers. Yeah, it's really, really weird. But so like you're always looking up to teenagers as a child. But when they made the kind of full length, fully produced, fully American produced movie, they were like, let's have a child character that the kids can sort of see the Power Rangers through, and they could be part of the heroism. And he's like landing from the skydiving, and this kid Fred is like, yeah, they're like, and it's Tommy. Like he was very much the movie star of that movie.
Right.
The other Rangers took a big backseat. Whereas I think when the series first started, there wasn't like one that was like really was out in front of the others. And I think this dude knew it, you know? The other thing that I was thinking about was how many kids in the 90s do you think took martial arts classes because of that man?
Probably like half.
I mean, all of them. I remember there was a White Ranger martial arts videotape you could get.
Did you have it?
No, I actually didn't. It was one of the few things I didn't. I had a massive collection, which is actually behind me. Martial arts tape.
Yeah, I had the his White Eagle.
The Falcon,
the Falcon Megazord or whatever.
Yes.
And with that attached to the back of the Megazord.
I see one now. There we go. Look at that. the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Karate Club, the White Ranger Kata. That's what it was called. The White Ranger Kata, featuring Sensei Jason David Frank, who probably was like 22 years old.
Wow.
Cause he died at 49. And it's, you know, it's really weird. Very recently he was promoting, he was like, I'm going to be in Dartmouth and then I'm going to be in, which is Dartmouth. Then I'm going to be in, Woodchester, and I'm going to be in Brockton, and I'm going to be at the Toy Vault. I'm going to be at Cranston. Maybe that's Rhode Island. Is that Rhode Island? These are all places that are like 10 minutes away from me. And, I think he already came through here, but he was like all, you talk to anybody, they'll be like, oh, he was going to make an appearance at my mall or whatever. Like spent a lot of time.
There. He came out there for fans. He like made time for them.
There's a few people in my life that I'm not all that close with, but like the one thing we know about each other is that we're really big Power Rangers fans. And so, yeah, it's been, you know, like, I don't know. This feels very, very bad. No. Jason David Frank.
No, it's sad. Definitely sad. You never want. So he's young. He had children, you know, you never want to see it.
The children thing is just about as bad as it gets. You got anything else?
Yeah, I'd hate to leave on that bummer, but
this will be for patrons only, right? I'll give you a quick some drama.
Okay.
So I was on this podcast called Binge Movies, and it was fun. He made me watch five movies from the 2000s, or from 2000, and we had a good conversation. It's up. You can go listen to it. I think it's a good conversation. The dude booked me like 8 months in advance, like off of the Cinemassacre stuff. And I thought that was, I mean, for like a little podcast, I thought that was a little strange. Like, you're booking your guests way out, are you? I mean, just a little self-important, shall I say. And I was given like this like Google Drive folder full of material that I was meant to read up on.
Was he a big shot?
And then
does he have a lot of views? I don't know.
I'm sitting, you know, no, it doesn't seem, you know, I think there's like 20 reviews on iTunes and no views on YouTube. He uploads the audio only to YouTube. So in advance of doing it, and again, it was fun. I think it was a good podcast, but in advance of doing it, I was like, well, I've got this YouTube channel. I'd like to be able to use the content on my channel a little bit or drive traffic to yours. Do you do video? Should we put up the video? Cause normally when I podcast, I put up the video. And he's like, oh, I don't really do that. And, I edit just the audio and then I'd have to edit the video. So no. And I was like, well, what are you recording it with? And he said Riverside. And I was like, well, it records the video anyway. I mean, like, I don't think there's like much of a, you don't have much of an option there. And he's like, all right, well, we'll see. He said, maybe you could do like spots. And then at the end of the episode, when we were done recording, I was like, so do you think you could give me the video? And maybe I could do something with it. And he was like, yeah, maybe if you could just do like, just some quick spots, not the whole thing. Cause you know, I edit it and I'd like to drive traffic to my show. And I said, yeah, that sounds great. I was like, and then I'll put up like maybe 5 minute clips, maybe three of them or something. And so like 2 weeks goes by, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that. And I was like, can I get that video? And he's like, doesn't respond to me like multiple times. Hmm. And then he finally goes, the video didn't record, just the audio. And I know he's lying. I know he's lying. Cause I use the same software. And I'm like, actually, if you just go here and download it, he goes, oh, you learn something new every day. And he sends me one of the clips because it got interrupted a couple of times.
Oh, I see.
And so he sent me the longest one, the hour and a half long one. And but I wanted the beginning because there was like a whole intro and I thought that's probably the clip I would use or whatever. So I'm like, hey, can I get the beginning, please? It's only like 20 more minutes to this. No response. I'm like, did you get my email? No response. He's just totally ghosting me all of a sudden. So he finally responds. And he goes, in my experience, the host guest dynamic is usually one where requests like this are made after rapport has been built and trust is established. Maybe after working together a few times. As I've stated from the start, I don't give out unedited material to guests. I do not give out videos. I don't typically even record video. I acquiesced. We're starting to get like bullshitty short sentences. Based on your insistence, And without us having any kind of established relationship, I have no assurance that you will respect my wishes with what you already have. You have around an hour and a half of less than 2 hours of material. New paragraph. So the answer is no. I really enjoyed our conversation and your thoughtful analysis of some random movies. Thanks for understanding. You want to help me?
Who does he think he is?
Where is he coming from on this?
It's like it seems like he escalated this from like, I don't know. He's asking for the manager at the first sign of anything. It's like I don't understand it. I don't understand why he would escalate it like that.
Well, I replied. You think I'm gonna?
No, you're gonna let that one lie.
I reply to YouTube comments. Yeah. I'm definitely replying. I said, you're genuinely concerned that I would just post the whole thing without your permission. I was going to see if I could fashion a couple of spots like we discussed to drive traffic to your show. The intro would help do that. I have an audience. They live on YouTube. They don't know what binge movies is. I'd have to show them. I thought I demonstrated trustworthiness, good faith, and dependability in all of our interactions. And indeed, if I was an asshole like that, the cat's out of the bag. I have the 1.5 hours. It's your show. I'm not going to beg you. I do regret that you've embarrassed me a bit in this email. I was insistent because you were unresponsive. I think going dark is an immature way to handle that you wanted to say no, as is suggesting that none of the video recorded, which was blatantly implausible, and not a great way to build rapport or trust, if that was your aim. No hard feelings. This is minor to me. Best of luck with the show.
Jeez. It's a perfect response. But yeah, it just seems like so deceitful.
But here's the thing. What's going on? I don't know what's going on.
I just think he's a prickly personality who, I don't know. Just
I think there's more to it.
You think there's more to it? What do you mean?
Here's the best theory I got. I think he's very protective, maybe of his image, like of his visual image. Like maybe because he's got like a big radio, maybe like he's got this big radio voice. Maybe he's like, no, I'm a radio personality. That's who I am. Don't show my face. There might be a because also like the microphone was like very much covering him the whole time, you know?
Mm.
Is there something like that going on? Perhaps like a
maybe.
Don't take my picture kind of thing.
Maybe, but he should just say that, like, hey, I'm just a radio guy. Like if he was just like straightforward with you, then you'd be like, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
That's the thing. If he had just said like, hey, I gotta be honest with you, man. Like hey, I really appreciate that you want to like drive traffic to the show and post any of this on your channel. First of all, you know, like, cause I don't need to be posting any of this shit on my channel. You know, because like we get like, you know, like we have a few thousand people that listen to this thing. And I really don't know who's listening to his. He has a Manscaped coupon.
Yeah.
Reads at the beginning. So maybe he's got something going
on. I listened to it. It's a very vulgar reading.
I'll tell you, if he has an audience, he has not indicated it to me in any way. There's no evidence on the internet in any way. And certainly nobody has subscribed to my channel going, Binge Movies sent me. I did this because a rando on the internet said, want to be on my podcast. And I did it. And I spent most of October watching movies to do it.
I thought it was a great podcast. So it's really disappointing that he blew it up like that.
So how hard would it have been to just be like, I gotta be honest with you. Like I, you know, I've got kind of a thing, like, I don't really want, I'm not like a video guy, you know? And so if you don't mind, I'd like to keep this audio only. Like, I'd be like, okay.
Yeah. It would be easy.
We asked.
That's the problem. It's like when you do like squirrely games where you're like, oh, you lie about video not being recorded and you like give it only parts of it. And
you're going to talk to me about trustworthiness? Yeah. And you're going to talk to me about being a liar? You're a fucking liar.
I don't know.
I'm really chafed.
No, like I said, it was disappointing. I thought it was a good podcast. So
yeah. Well, hey, go listen to it.
Stinks. That guy's a loser.
Knowing full well what happened, maybe this sounds rich coming from me, but self-importance is a poisonous thing.
Yeah.
As we started with James, in the course of my creative endeavors, I've always been around like other creatives who think that they're operating at some level that they're not operating on. Like, you know, you, like on a set of a student film, they all think that, like, you know, they kind of like over engineer the production sort of to put on a show for themselves about how important and cool the thing that they're doing is. Mm-hmm. I think there's a bit of that going on here. Yeah. I think there's a lot of that going on.
Oh yeah. It's a little bit of a, yeah, it's, there's a performance within it, with, even in that interaction, like, yeah. So the answer is no. It's like, it's a little,
yeah, little theater kid of you.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't think I don't see through it. Putting on this affect.
Oh.
Anyway, go listen to binge movies.
Go listen to it. I did buy the new Pokemon game, which I hear is full of bugs. I did not play it because I'm trying to finish my turkey video before Thanksgiving. So.
Oh shoot! Oh,
so it's almost done. It's almost done. I just have to.
That'll be fine.
I just have to wrap it up. It should be done by tomorrow.
I got Black Friday coming up. I'm going to my sister's in Maine. We're running a road race, and then Black Friday. I think we're going to do Providence Place Mall. We've somehow never done the Providence Place Mall on Black Friday. I mean, I think this is our eighth year, and you know, so we're getting it to be like a decade of Black Fridays here.
That's crazy. And yeah. Yeah, and then so you'll pencil in a nice like vaccine argument with your sister.
Try to avoid it. I think by now she must know that the vaccines didn't work. Yeah, they really eradicated it, didn't they?
All gone.
I'm going to get in so much trouble. I don't even think it's real. Like, you see the SNL sketch where they were like, there's like a whole sketch about how like COVID is not real anymore.
I haven't watched
SNL. Oh, now you say it.
Oh, and then we'll be recording the Christmas special next weekend too.
Yes. Yeah. So what are we?
You have a busy week, Mr.
I'm going to be so tired. I'm not looking forward to it. We were trying to shoot. We wanted to do this cranberry thing with John. That fell through because he got sick. We were going to shoot last weekend. That fell through because he was sick.
Yeah.
Apparently Matt got him sick. And now Matt's like, but can I like come? Because I'm not available that day. Got to like figure out like what we're doing with Matt. Yeah. There's just too much to do. You know, and then there's like this Bimmy book somewhere in the mix.
Yeah. I'm sure. No time, my kids.
Time is finite, as it so happens. You have to choose what you're spending it on. I in the book, I saw some stuff about like he edits together cool videos of his family and stuff. It sounds like sounds like he's a good dad.
Yeah.
Get off James's dick, would you, everybody?
Yeah. He's overcoming autism.
I wouldn't make fun of him. I wouldn't dare.
I wouldn't dare have a YouTube video with lots of views making fun. Yeah.
I can't attribute any of my YouTube channel success to making fun of him.
No, definitely
or all not. Of it.